anyone who is has an interest in Australia's military history would no doubt have heard and read my next guest. His name is Michael Veitch. He's just published, in the last couple of days, in fact, his 11th book, and it's called Australia's Secret Army. It's an absolutely gripping and fascinating tale, incredible amount of research as well. The detail that Michael has been able to draw out of the archives is just extraordinary. It's a fantastic read, and certainly I had no idea about the subject of this book, so we're lucky to get a bit of an explanation, first of all, from Michael. He joins us now. I understand he's in a dog park in the Yarra Valley outside Melbourne. Michael, welcome to the King Review.
Oh, thank you very much, Gavin. Yes, I have my red heeler and my blue heeler at my feet, who are shocked that I'm not giving them my full attention with the ball. So if you hear some random barking and some good Australian pedigree dog complaining, you know, that's what it is. It isn't the dogs of war, it's my own dogs.
It's your own dogs, very good. And people, of course, will know you, Michael, which you might touch on a little bit later in our chat. Know you, of course, from our TV screens, but we might get to that a little bit later.
Oh, some of the older listeners might remember me vaguely.
Oh, I'm sure that's not the case. All right, Australia's Secret Army. It is all about the Coast Watchers, as I said there in the intro. I'd certainly never heard of the Coast Watchers, which is no doubt why the title is called Australia's Secret Army. Michael Veitch, tell us about the Coast Watchers. Who were they?
Coast Watchers were a part of an organisation set up after World War I because it was realised that Australia's northern border was basically completely open. Apparently during World War I, German ships used to come and just sail around the place and sort of thumb their nose at the Australian defences.
Have a bit of a laugh.
And they... Yeah, basically. And there was a report that I actually held in my hands, but they had the paragraph, it's in the 20s, it's estimated that some parts of Australia's army, a foreign army could literally land a couple of divisions, and it would be weeks before we realised they were even there.
They were here. Wow.
And that was like, I actually burst out laughing when I read it, but it's actually true. So they set up, the Royal Australian Navy had the very brilliant idea of saying, why don't we just enlist civilians to keep an eye on the place where they live? And this was a very simple system. They weren't paid. They were essentially civilians. And this extended into the Australian territories of New Guinea and the Solomon Islands in between the war years. So you had planters and missionaries and colonial administrators and police, just part of the Coast Watcher system that was set up in the early 20s of Western European Australians just having this extra job that if they saw something untoward in sort of strange ships and later aeroplanes, they would report it to a sort of central office, often via telegraph or radio or something like that. When the war came, however, the system was ramped up considerably, because it was realised we really do need eyes to our northern border. So they recruited a whole bunch of people all through the New Guinea Islands and the Solomon Islands in the first year of the war. And when the Japanese came and suddenly occupied all these very same areas, this group of civilians had to kind of basically pivot between being kind of sort of benign observers to suddenly spies operating behind enemy lines. So that's why their story is so dramatic. And then they continued to do this incredible work reporting on just about every aspect of what the Japanese were up to during all across those early years of the battles of the Southwest Pacific.
And tell listeners, what did they have any training? Did they have any support from the government? Were they just out there on their own?
They were more or less on their own. Every Coast Watcher, particularly in New Guinea and Solomons, needed to have a network of loyal natives. And no cost Coast Watcher could have done their job without a really supportive group of the native people, and that their story has never really been told, and I've tried to do that in the book. Most of them were equipped with a radio, which had the radio, I said in the book, can we include what we hold on our phones, what I'm holding now, talking to you on this tiny little thing that we have that can do all this amazing stuff. Well, 80 years ago, the Coast Watch's means of communication of choice was the AWA 3B teleradio, right. Which was a very efficient valve shortwave and longwave radio that had voice capability and Morse capability, but it was the size and weight of a small family car
exactly.
And had to be transported across wow. some of the most rugged and unforgiving terrain in the world. Mm. So they had some air support. They had supplies dropped to them when they could be found. Often they couldn't be found. It was they were too remote. Often the supply system, the supplies often dropped to the wrong place or didn't get there. So they were more or less on their own. And but they kept reporting. There was one Coast Watch guy called Paul Mason who essentially saved the Battle of Guadalcanal mm-hmm. by alerting the Americans via a five-word message that he gave, which simply said, 24 bombers heading yours, which he signaled over open voice from his mountain position high in the mountains of northern Bougainville. Watch these planes go over. Mm. Sent the signal to Port Moresby, was relayed to Townsville, then Canberra, then they relayed it to Honolulu.
Oh my God.
And they alerted the Americans because at that moment the Americans were disembarking the Marines to begin the campaign of Guadalcanal. Mm. And the surprise Japanese air attack was foiled by this 90-minute warning given by a Coast Watcher.
I was going to ask, so it was 90 minutes. They had 90 minutes warning.
90 minutes flying time, you see, because he was he observed these Japanese aircraft heading towards the southwest. He didn't know where they were going, but he knew that he gave the direction. And they were able to kind of calculate where these planes were headed. Because it was the morning, it was June the 5th or 6th, 1942, when the Americans had begun the Great Guadalcanal Campaign and they were unloading their ships. But with that warning, they pulled their ships away, scrambled their aircraft from the decks of the carrier, USS Wasp, and fell upon the Japanese unescorted bombers as they thought they were they had the advantage of a surprise attack, but the surprises were a surprise. And that the Coast Watchers then played an incredibly important role in this great battle of Guadalcanal and other battles by just simply tormenting the Japanese by spying and relaying everything they saw of their movements.
Absolutely incredible. There is a fascinating passage in the book, about halfway through the book, and it relates to Cairns, to our part of the world. Of course, yeah. Our geographic location in terms of the Pacific, so critical, so close to PNG. I just wanted to have a quick little read here. You write here that on the 28th of March, 1942, the Lakatoi, which was a ship, received pratique to enter Cairns Harbour. Her overcrowded decks filled with emaciated men and her hurriedly painted hull making a peculiar and unnerving spectacle. You go on to write that when the men stepped off onto Australian soil, they were formed up in threes and marched away from the wharf up the main street of Cairns. It was a quiet Saturday afternoon and the few onlookers who were present stared blank-faced at these ragged, bearded soldiers who looked like a ghost army marching in loose formation, tears streaming down their faces. Michael Veitch, give us the background to that passage. What happened to the Lakatoi and the men on that boat?
These were the sad remnants of Lark Force, the battalion of men, Australian soldiers, more or less from the suburbs of Melbourne and Hobart, who'd been sent in early 1941 to secure Rabaul, the great port town, and then the capital of New Guinea on the island of New Britain. Now, they knew the Japanese were going to take it. And this completely untrained, completely inadequate force was basically sacrificed by the Australian government to save face, basically. They sort of sent too few men that they sent there to withstand the Japanese invasion, which was done by the cream of their troops in February 1942. The battle lasted about a few hours, and then the men basically sort of were shattered and had to disperse their way through New Britain on this retreat. led by a coast watcher called Keith McCarthy, who basically, like the Pied Piper, kind of rallied these poor boys that had been shattered in battle because they didn't that they weren't trained properly. There wasn't enough of them anyway. And he organized a retreat along the northern coast of New Britain in this some of the most rugged and inhospitable terrain in the world. The Australian government authorities were completely uncooperative. They had no real ideas. They said, oh, find your way to the New Guinea mainland and walk over the hills and we'll pick you up there. He said, serious? These people are on death's door now. They had their clothes were deteriorating. They had no food. What the men of L'Arc Force went through is it was one of the great disgraces of Australian governmental and military history. It's terrible what we did to them, just abandoning these fellows like this. Enter a woman. Enter on an island, a plantation island, about 20 miles to the north of New Britain, was a woman called Gladys Baker, who's a wonderfully independent woman and a real kind of film star. She had film star good looks. She was quite beautiful. Her husband had died a couple of years earlier. She and her husband ran a copra plantation on this island, and she got wind of the fact that there was retreating Australians, and she sailed her own yacht. She was also a superb yachtswoman and an immaculate dresser. She always wore them, because they're quite wealthy, always wore the most beautiful clothes. And she turned up to the beach where Keith McCarthy, in despair, was saying, what am I going to do with these men? They're going to be dead before I can get them back home. And she basically walked up the beach with this sort of all these bedraggled, starving, filthy, emaciated men, and this vision of beauty gets off a yacht and strolls up the beach and says, oh, hello, who's in charge here? And they pointed to McCarthy and said, well, I live on that island in the distance there, and I actually have a ship. You can have it if you want. And that was the lack
They must have
of
thought they were hallucinating or something. Sure.
They thought that they literally thought they were. Some of them thought they were hallucinating and then died and gone to heaven, and heaven was in the form of this beautiful, tall, elegant woman walking up the beach, completely confident. And they all just thought she was the most wonderful person in the world. And so she arranged for a small group to go over and take the ship and bring the ship in stages, because the Japanese were looking for these people too. So in stages, they brought all the men over, and then that was the Lakatoi. They had to offload its cargo of copra that was about to sail. The only reason it hadn't sailed is because the captain of the ship was too scared. He thought, we're going to be sunk. I'm not going to take this ship anywhere. But she said, well, you can give it to the Australian Army. Thank you very much, because they need it. And so they sailed. They were originally going to sail to New Guinea, but all the places along New Guinea they could have sailed to were falling to the Japanese. So they ran the great risk of sailing all the way from New Britain around the eastern tip of Papua and then down to Cairns. And they came into Cairns Harbour, and apparently the sight was incredible. And a few of the accounts are watching, because, oh, some of our soldiers have arrived. And they looked at them and went, oh, my God, look at them. And they were in the worst state. All the uniforms had basically rotted and deteriorated. They were starving. They were traumatized. Very few of those men, those couple of hundred men who crammed onto that boat, went back into active service. They had shot their bolt. But they at least got off. And I don't know what happened to the ship after that, but Gladys Baker is one of the great heroines of this story, whose story has never really been told before, which is one of the reasons I wanted to write the book.
You also write here, speaking of Gladys, just to finish up that little passage, saying, upon arrival in Cairns, Gladys Baker had lost 4 stone in weight and, like the men, was suffering from malnutrition. But her worst moment was having her beloved dog taken away and shot by Australian custom officials as it was considered a threat to local health. That is not nice at all.
Weren't they nice?
Oh, jeez.
I know.
Just rescued a couple hundred men. But anyway, all right.
I nearly cried when I read that, when I discovered
everything
that.
Everything
she did. And I can at least take my little dog. This little dog. And they say, oh, no, that's ours, lady. Probably got, foot and mouth disease or whatever.
Whatever it was, yeah. Terrible. That's the first part of my chat with author and former comedy TV star Michael Veitch. After the next song, we'll have a chat to Michael about the nature of TV these days and political correctness and what you can and can't get away with when it comes to comedy.